when I started to read about creativity, I found that we had creativity in the psychological field, creativity in art, obviously, in design, in marketing. There were theories developed in all these fields and in other fields as well. And people were theorizing about the creative process, and psychologists are theorizing about issues of inspiration. Even people are theorizing about qualification. Are there qualifications necessary or involved, etc.? And then I went to a dictionary definition, which the Oxford Dictionary said, the use of imagination or original ideas to create something, inventiveness. So it seems very generic, kind of. But creative theories, if we go back to pre-Renaissance time, the assumption was that creation was divinely inspired. This is in a European context. So, and this dictionary definition, I would say, comes from a European context. It doesn't come from Delhi or Seoul or Vladivostok. With the Enlightenment, the idea of the genius of man became predominant. So divine inspiration was superseded, for the most part, by the genius of man. So we see that a lot of the art and architecture and expression of the pre-Renaissance period is focused on religious subject matter. It's divinely inspired to open up the divine to the world at large. But after that, the idea of the genius of man, then it started to get very diverse. So we get it diverse on all levels of art. So it's not, now we're not talking about art that's divinely inspired. It means you can represent anything and everything. So we have, wonderful realism, and then impressionism, and it's on all levels. We have literature, where novels, which were always there, but now they become a genre that's more than acceptable. In fact, you know, your idea about, you know, your imaginative idea is really, really necessary. So this use of imagination. And then we have to ask maybe even a question to do with physics to some degree. This is your field, Gyan. Is creation a new thing, or is it a reformation of things that already exist? Is it a combination of energies that already exist? You're just combining them in a new way, but is that new, or is that reformation? So how new is new? That's also an issue to do with creation, and it's certainly an important issue in Hindu thought. It's certainly discussed. And then going back to the kind of the issue of divine inspiration or human genius, this has become a kind of something of polar opposites. It's kind of one or the other. You know, we've created a situation where you have to choose one of these. So if the Supreme is the arbiter of all that is created, then and all that will be created, then not only can we claim newness, but can we claim creation? If the Supreme is the arbiter of creation. So that just adds a little spanner into the works. A Hindu thought will not deny the genius of man and will not deny the genius of God. Both these things stand. Now, this seems incompatible intellectually in what we're used to, the kind of discourse we're used to, where it's kind of one or the other a little bit. It's faith and reason, faith or reason. So it's not faith and reason, it's faith or reason, a little bit. Hinduism has no issue about faith and has no issue about reason. Has no issue about God and has no issue about man. That's not going to be there's no assumption in the discourse. So we could be going along about the Nima, I think we need another chair. Yeah, there are chairs outside. Thank you. So over the next few days, we're going to examine the nature of creativity, what it entails, what its qualities are, what its patterns are, and to some extent, the practical implications of creativity. When we're talking about temple building, that's a practical implication. When we're talking about a procession coming out of a temple, that's a practical implication. Prayer is a practical implication. But there's also implications to do with politics and economics and social policy and political theory. So it does begin to expand, and certainly in an Indian context, it's very important to see the implications at all levels of social discourse. And it's very difficult to understand India without that broader vision. So, for instance, I go to Chennai Airport, and I go to the baggage hall, and big baggage hall, obviously, and there's a big Murti of Ganesh. And it's about this high, and there's always incense burning every time I go. It's always fresh flowers and garland have been offered. Two policemen walk by and stop and bow down and continue walking. These are state employees. This is a state-controlled airport. The state installed this deity. This is a secular state. What's the thinking behind this? Who's not putting their hand up to say, oh, hang on a minute, why do they not think like that? It's interesting. In this space, you have this other space, completely different assumptions, both of them existing together. So the idea of either or, you supplant it philosophically with both and, in every case. And then you can begin to understand creativity from Hindu sources in a much more comprehensive way. If you reduce it to either or you allow it to be reduced for you by, you know, how you read the text or how you read the painting or how you read the sculpture, then you're limiting not only yourself, but you're limiting the expression of what's in front of you. So it's, you know, you're not allowing yourself to understand it, but you're not allowing the person who's presented this to express it to you. So it's, for instance, it's a religious painting. Is that all? Are there other facets to it as well? So we can't limit anything. So what sometimes looks like a religious painting or a religious idea or a religious text in Hinduism, at another level of understanding, is not at all religious. It's actually quite mundane. So we first encounter it as a religious text. So for instance, many people come across the Kama Sutra. In the 1970s, the Kama Sutra hit the West like a tornado of sexuality and all that kind of stuff. No one ever read the text, they just looked at the pictures. But if you are engaged with the Kama Sutra, if someone reads it as a spiritual text, so they're very attached sexually, and this is a way to rationalize sexuality that makes it more meaningful and makes it something beyond yourself. So you begin to look at yourself differently, look at your partner differently, look at the world differently, etc. So 10 years later, you've been practicing this, and you've kind of got yourself fairly much under control, and then you look back at the text and you think, well, that's not very spiritual at all, really, is it? No. You know, so in one circumstance, in one snapshot of space and time, this is the essence of your spirituality. This is your way in. And another snapshot, it's neither here nor there. Been there, done that. So the idea of creativity is very relaxed. And to make it either or, to say that this is or isn't a spiritual text, is much too simplistic. To say it is or it isn't, and to give it a hard border, it depends who's looking at the text. So I go back to who defines creativity. In that context, everyone has their own individual definition, dependent on how they're looking, how they're seeing. And what's the Sanskrit word for that? What did you say?
Darshan.
Darshan. How do you see? And darshan is the word that's always used in Sanskrit to describe what we call in Greek as philosophy. Philosophy means the love of knowledge or wisdom. But in Sanskrit, or in Indian philosophical thought, it doesn't mean the love of knowledge, it means how do you see the world. And that's a very different idea, a very different approach. And if that's how you're defining it, then by definition, every single person is seeing the world differently. That's just a given. We all have different conditioning. We're all looking at it. We're all sitting around this table looking at each other from different angles. We're seeing the world differently, which means there is an inherent pluralism. So I can't say that this text is this or that. I have to find out this. I understand what it is for me, but I don't understand what it is for someone else. And I can't really tell them that this is a useless text, when for them it could be actually a very useful text. So that idea of pluralism comes from these assumptions. And let's get into that a little bit more deeply. I'm going to go down and bring the board up.
We don't need many pages out of the
end. I don't need any pages.
I'm not going to write too many words here.
But so I'm going to look at creativity first philosophically.
Philosophically, some of you will have seen this word before.
Everyone knows that word? Ritta? Or is this often spelled? Ritta? But this is kind of a rr. And this word here, the R with the dot under it, is a word. And it also has philosophical import. But Ritta is first mentioned in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest of Hindu texts, it's the oldest book of philosophy that we know of on the planet. And this is a very old philosophical assumption upon which nearly all Indian thought is based, and I would include Buddhism, Jainism and Sikhism in that. But I would also include Indian Christianity, Indian Islam, tribal religions, Farsi. Anyone who's kind of connected with India and stayed there for a long time begins to think like this. And it's an observation. So I would go so far as to say, can I say, oh, it's being recorded, can't say. But the whole of the subcontinent thinks like this. Consciously or unconsciously, but unconsciously, as far as my observation goes. Ritta is... it's a very simple concept. It just means cosmic order. It is an assumption that there is cosmic order. So thinkers have just observed how the world works, and they just look at the acorn produces an oak, not a banyan, in every case. It's highly organized. How the planets move, highly organized. The whole thing is highly organized. And we're here for 70, 80, 90 years. And in that little snapshot, we appear, it's already organized, and we're going to go, and it will continue on its own inevitable thing. So there is cosmic order. It's just a basic observational assumption, but it leads to philosophy. From this idea comes idea of dharma, seva, ahimsa, varnashram, purusharta, karma, reincarnation, everything we know is Hinduism, but also a lot of what we know is Buddhism and Jainism come from these ideas. For the purposes of today, I'll just read off some of the things here. What cosmic order includes. And this is where theory of creativity starts to make sense. Cosmic order includes order and chaos. Includes balance and imbalance. Includes harmony and discord. And includes happiness and distress. And all of that makes up the whole. So where you have opposites not being reconciled or seeing a need to reconcile them, there is an inherent pluralism emerges. The idea of opposites is normal. So for instance, happiness and distress, we often in the West, we have an idea about suffering that the East, based on this philosophical perspective, would find unhealthy. That suffering is a bad thing. And it's something to get rid of. And I first noticed this in 1984. I was in Brighton, in England. And I just come over from Ireland, which is still to this day a little bit more less organized than England. But in that time it was more unorganized. And I went past an accident on the road. And it had more or less just happened. And drove past and came back 10 minutes later. And it was gone. Every trace of it was gone. Now, in Ireland, people would still be milling around talking about it, talking to all the people involved, talking to the ambulance drivers, talking to the policemen, and everyone else would, and the policemen would be talking back to them and explaining everything in great detail. And it would become a community event, and people would bring out cups of tea and biscuits, and, you know, it's just, all of a sudden it was gone, and I realized that people don't want to see it. They don't want to know it. It's not a happy thing. You know, it's something to... anyway, I'll quote from the Bhagavad Gita. This is the second chapter, text 14. Matras prashas tu kunteya shitosna sukadukada agama payano nityas tams titikshaswa bharata. So, O son of Kunti, which is Arjuna, Krishna is saying to Arjuna, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. So this is a philosophical development of this very simple concept. If there is cosmic order, and this order has two sides in every case, then philosophically, this makes total sense. So you can see how Indian, and this philosophy, although quoted by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, this is basic Upanishadic philosophy. So he's repeating the Upanishads. That this happiness and distress, don't get caught up in this. Don't get bewildered by this. Don't get attached to happiness. And don't get attached to distress, which is something we also do. Sometimes we make being a victim a kind of a professional perspective. You know, and it's a way we can get easy. I mean, as children, we learned that pretty quickly. A good wail, get your lungs together and rah, get out that wail, and you'll get attention. You know, and we learned fairly soon how to do that. In that sense, the creative process is ongoing. It's continuing. So these opposites working with each other, happiness, stress working with each other. The creation and the dissolution is an ongoing process. It doesn't end. It's never ceased. And it's being acted out on every level of existence. So it's being acted out here on the philosophical level. So that philosophical level is actually our lives. You know, the idea of happiness, we're very attached to. The idea of distress, less so. But Krishna is saying to Arjuna, actually these are just two sides of one coin. The coin is the same. You're looking for the coin. But if you get this side, you're going to get that side. And just, you have to live with that. You can't be an illusion and just say, I only want to see the bright side. That will lead to more than distress, but madness. The idea of moha in Indian thought is one of the things to avoid getting caught up in. And we become mad when we misidentify. And we'll get into identification in a minute. Now, I want to... Another word...
Ritu. Any Hindi speakers? Mm-hmm. Everyone knows what Ritu means? Anyone volunteer?
Well, the simple one is weather.
Weather? Or?
Season.
Traditions?
What's that?
Tradition.
I wouldn't have said tradition, but you said it, so I won't argue. So season. Yeah. It's in Hindi, it's used as season. In Sanskrit, from which Hindi comes, it's also used to mean cycle. That's why it means season in Hindi. It means cycle. The idea of cycles in nature. Everything in nature works in cycles. That would be the weather, as we've mentioned. It would be time. It would be thought. Cycles of life. So we go from childhood to youth to old age. It's a cycle. Cycles of thought is interesting because we have meditation, processes of meditation coming out of India. Indian philosophers would say the processes of meditation aren't Indian. They're just normal processes of mental processes. So how do we look at meditation? Well, you have to sit down and go into a pose and all that kind of stuff. And they're saying, well, no, that's not how it works. It's just a cycle. Just understand the principle behind it. It's a cycle. Thoughts work in cycles. So if you want to focus your meditation, then understand that this thought is going to come again. So put a thought in to the cycle and it will come around again. And when it comes around again, meditate on it, focus on it. And then when it comes around again, focus on it. And that's our experience. We're walking past the shop and we see a thing in the window and we go, oh, a thing. Oh, I like the thing. And then you go, oh, no. I don't have time. But we're walking on, and as we're walking on, we're kind of meditating on the thing. And then we push out of our mind because it's too expensive, and I don't want my partner to know that I spent that much money on a thing, and whatever, all the kind of things. So you put it out of your mind, and then you walk into the same street the next day. You haven't even got to the shop, but even the same street pulls back the thought, and it comes back, and it's the depth of meditation is the depth you left it with yesterday. And then you deepen the meditation, or you decide to let it go. But you can deepen the meditation. And then you start to get crafty and say, my partner won't know if I take the money from there and put it back next week. And, you know, it starts to become tactical. At that stage, you're kind of lost. But anyway. but when we think meditation, we think empty the mind and all that. Actually, that's not what they're saying. It's part of a cycle, that everything in nature works in cycles. The body works in cycles. The nature itself, the seasons are cycles. The day works in cycles. Here we wake up in the morning, and then there's moon, and then there's twilight, and then there's the evening. So it's just cycles. So again, this is observational. But it means that there are these opposites that are an integral part of the whole. You can't just take out summer and say, let it all be summer, because then the whole process doesn't work. You can't take out youth and say, I just want to be young. Now, a lot of us do, and that's why plastic surgery exists. But the fact is, we can't do anything about it. You know, it's a process. There's a cycle. You just go with the flow of the cycle. And as you go with the flow of the cycle, then you're not going to be disturbed. Otherwise, that's the idea. You're appreciating the cosmic order. So the idea of cosmic order has become quite profound. It's become part of who we are. But understanding that these opposites exist is the essential part, and that we have to work with opposites. So again, you come to an idea of pluralism. There's an assumption of pluralism. There's an assumption of more than one thing. It's never one thing. So if someone comes with another thing, it's not a question of saying, oh, I have my thing, therefore you're wrong. It's a question of examining the other thing. How can that thing inform my thing? Maybe I need to see the other thing to understand my thing. You know, maybe that's the other side of my thing, etc. There's some, and, well, will we get into Sankhya philosophy? No, we won't. Sankhya philosophy is great, but not for today. One thing I will say about Sankhya philosophy, because I don't think anyone else is going to cover it, when we talk about the opposites, Sankhya philosophy is often seen as atheistic, which classical Sankhya is atheistic. Well, it's not atheistic, it's non-theistic. It doesn't deny the existence of God, it just doesn't deal with the existence of God, which is a very different idea. And again, that intellectually chimes with this idea of opposites and possibilities. When you talk about cosmic order, you're talking about possibilities. Possibilities are very broad, because we don't know what's going on. We don't know what the other side of the thing is, in most cases. So there's always the possibility that the thing I think is exactly correct is moderated by another thing. So, but Sankhya is about opposites. It's about Purusha and Prakriti. In some traditions, you have the idea of Purusha and Prakriti. I suppose I should do that. I won't write the words up because I'll just. These opposites work with each other to create. But theologically, and again, this is where the non-theistic philosophy becomes theistic, incomprehensibly. This is, and as I say, this is the Indian way. You have to understand that as soon as you establish a non-theistic approach, someone's going to establish a theistic approach. As soon as you establish a theistic approach, someone will do the opposite. So the idea of opposites is essential to understand. But so you've got these two opposites, and it's all about creation, it's all about the interaction of material elements, etc. So it's an interesting philosophy of understanding how the world works. But on the theological level, you have Purusha and Prakriti. And Prakriti, Purusha is the creator, and Prakriti are the created. And these are all interconnected. And in Gaudiya tradition, in Vallabha tradition, in Sri Vaishnavism, etc., Purusha is the supreme, and Prakriti is everybody else. And the supreme is looked on as male, and everybody else is looked on as female. So the idea that, so everyone in this room, from a spiritual point of view, are female. So when you go into most Vaishnava temples, well, most temples of any kind, but in Vaishnava temples you'll have Lakshmi Narayan or Radha and Krishna, two forms on the altar, Purusha and Prakriti, we think, but not the case. Purusha. Because the idea of maleness is not without femaleness. So the Purusha is both male and female on the altar. Just to boggle the mind. How creative can you get? So when you go into a temple, you've got Radha and Krishna, for instance, but theologically, Radha is what they call Pladini Shakti, which is the expression of God's ability to enjoy. An intrinsic part of God, same person. It's just manifest in two different ways. In expressed as male and female, that's how we would understand it, but one person. Mind-boggling. And then that's not only creative on a theological level, but as I say, you walk into a temple, someone has carved this and done it quite beautifully. And then someone has decorated these forms. Someone has gardened so that the specific flowers of the region, the most fragrant flowers, can be offered to these forms. People have made jewelry. It's all the creativity that comes out of this, expression. Anyway, I just meant that's why I didn't want to get into Sankhya. It's mind-boggling. Right. Okay, another thing I want to mention just very quickly is the idea in Hinduism that nothing comes from nothing. And this is not necessarily the idea of Buddhism. And it's not necessarily not the idea of Buddhism, or the idea of Buddhism. Depends which Buddhist you're talking to. But some Buddhists talk about sunyavad, which is the void. And some forms of Buddhism don't talk about that at all. They have deities as well, deities of the Buddha, to which they offer incense and make offerings of food. And it's very much like Hinduism in that kind of, it's very Indian in that sense. But some are very strict about the fact that there is no God, etc. So again, it's individual interpretation. But Indian thought would say that nothing comes from nothing. So if we think of examples of creation, can anyone give an example of creation? Creating, baking a cake. What do you need? You need stuff, right? You need flour and sugar and water and whatever. Procreation, you need stuff, no matter how it's done. You can have a man and a woman, we would have said that 30 years ago. Now you just need a test tube or whatever. But there's two things, there's a sperm and an egg. But there are ingredients. So can you think of something that doesn't have ingredients? That's the kind of painting a picture. You need acrylic or oil or water or color or etc. So no creation from nothing. And then another kind of principle is that there's no creativity without chaos. Creativity seems to indicate harmony and balance. You know, a lot of creativity that we see is something harmonious and balanced, etc. And some people in more modern eras try to exemplify chaos as well, and discord in their music, in their painting, etc., in their sculpture. But in Hinduism, it's now this idea of no creativity without chaos. I think this is you're going to see this throughout this weekend, and I'm going to give you because this is what I'm going over at the moment. We'll get into divine and human, never from nothing. Desire, we're going to do, qualification. Continue what we've mentioned, not without chaos. We create ourselves, I'll mention that, and we'll mention that a little bit. You'll find that these ideas, as you're going through everyone else's presentation, you'll begin to see these ideas come alive a little bit. And what we're going to talk about now is desire. Desire is, the word is, and this will be up all the time, so you don't have to worry about that just for now, but everyone's heard the word karma, simply meaning desire. A karma is another important word that is mentioned in the Rig Veda, that's where it first comes up. The idea of desire is dealt with in every Indian text. From the Rig Veda, interestingly, Ritta is hardly ever mentioned again. It's everything that comes out of it is mentioned. But Kama, desire, is dealt with in the Upanishads, in the Mahabharata, in the Ramayana, in the Puranas. Everyone deals with the idea of desire. It becomes a very important notion. And it becomes an important notion for two reasons. One because of Ritta, and the other, a reason I'll mention a little later. But the idea that it all starts with desire. Now we have the Bhagavad Purana is arguably the most influential Hindu text. And it's very alive today in India. Well, not today in India. Today in this country, there's about 25 Bhagavad Kathas happening in this country over the summer period. That's 7-day recitations. And this is happening in North America, Australasia, the Middle East, and all over India. When we go to India now, you see these huge big billboards with Bhagavad Saptas all over the place. Very much a living tradition. In the Bhagavad Purana, there are many creation stories. and three of them, well, two of them, we're going to deal with, Anuradha is going to deal with, just focusing on, one of them, possibly the biggest one, the churning of the milk ocean. Very, very well known. When you go into Bangkok airport, there's a huge, big diorama of the churning of the milk ocean. It's the national story of Thailand, that and the Ramayana. And they're quite convinced that they have nothing to do with India. and she's going to deal with the Nasadiya Sutta, which is part of the Rig Veda. But this is a text from the Bhagavad. This is Lord Brahma. This is the creator of the universe. So it's interesting that the creator of the universe isn't considered to be God. He's a kind of a civil servant. He's designated. So the creator of the universe, there's only one Brahma temple in the whole of India. He's not considered very seriously for all the work he's done. and so this is a text from the Bhagavatam. Lord Brahma, in his ignorance, contemplated, "Who am I that I'm situated on the top of this lotus?" So he becomes aware of himself sitting on the top of a lotus in darkness. And he just wakes up and he says, "Who am I? What's going on?" And he says, "Where from has it sprouted? There must be something downwards, and that from which this lotus has grown, it must be within the water." Because a lotus obviously is attached to water. So that's the beginning of Brahma contemplating what's going on. But from this comes a desire to find out. And based on that desire, all creation happens. He finds out who he is, what his purpose is, then he gets on with the job. So this idea of desire, what's our motivation? And everyone, absolutely everyone, is motivated. When we become lacking in motivation, that's when our system starts to break down mentally and physically. But you know, what is our motive? What is our motive? What is your desire? How do you keep your desire straight? This is an Andavardhana, who's a medieval poet. He says, "I am weary from much painting of the world, for though I used the new and wondrous sight of poets, which busies itself in giving taste and feeling, and use the insight of philosophers, which shows us objects that are really there, I never found, O God, recumbent on the ocean, a joy like that which comes from love of thee." So again, where is his desire? He's gone through art, he's gone through philosophy, and now he's talking about something else. And so his desire isn't a static thing. Desire is changing all the time, developing. And it's developing in whatever direction we choose for it to develop. And speaking of choice, we'll come back to choice. First we'll go on to the other big idea, another big idea from the Rig Veda that permeates all of the before. Atma means
soul.
Any other takers?
Self.
What's that?
Self.
Self. Self. Self is better than soul. Has a bit of baggage with it. So it's the one that everyone usually trots out because it's kind of more comprehensible. But when you say the self, it's kind of, you've gone esoteric, new agey a little bit, so soul just sounds, you know, more grounded or something. But let's talk about what it actually means. So it does refer to the self, exactly the case. And it refers to every facet of the self in the Rig Veda. And by the time you get to the Upanishads, it's begun to focus more on the non-material part of the self. It doesn't ever deny that all those parts are part of the self, but its inquiry is, who are we? What is the self? Now, if we go to the Upanishads and see the Upanishadic, in the Chandogya Upanishad, Udalaka Runi speaking to Shwetaketu. Udalaka Runi is the guru in this case. He says, "Bring me a banyan fruit and cut it up." "Here it is, sir." "What do you see there?" Udalaka Runi is Shwetaketu's father, acting as his teacher. "These very tiny seeds, sir. Now take one of them and cut it up and tell me what you see." "Nothing, sir, because it's just got too small." Then he told him, "This finest essence that constitutes the self of the whole world, that is the truth, that is the self, the Atman, and that's how you are, Tattvamasi, Shwetaketu." He also does it, he says, "Take this salt, which you can see, now put it in the water. Now what do you see?" So what is the self? This is a solid thing. In that context, it's not a solid thing, still there. So he's helping him understand what's the significant self. We can identify ourselves. Well, how would we identify ourselves? Who wants to identify themselves to me?
We did it in the beginning.
Knowing that this is a trick. Exactly. So we have your identities from the beginning. We see everyone identifies themselves by name and occupation. And Shanaka Rishidas, Irish, obviously wasn't born with that name. So we can change our name. And we can change our occupation, obviously. So the Indian philosophers are looking for something more substantial. What's the part of you that doesn't change? That's why the Upanishadic understanding is talking about the essential self and isn't so interested in other aspects of the self. We have the William Blake thing is good. To see a world in a great grain of sand, you know that quote, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. And it's that's kind of Upanishadic thought. It's mirrored here, you know, very, very interestingly. The juxtaposition. It's talking about eternity. What part of you is not material? Because everything material is time-bound. So what's not time-bound? And their first observation is desire. Our desire isn't time-bound. Our desire is for a happiness without end. We don't want our happiness to end. That's a totally ridiculous desire, because everything in our experience ends. So they're saying, well, where does the desire come from? What part of us produces something that desires something that doesn't exist, unless it exists maybe within us, because it's our desire. And then you meet X number of other people and you ask them, do you want your happiness to end? No, no, no. Everyone you meet in every culture and every language, if you can break through and ask the simple question, everyone will come up with the same answer. Do you want your happiness to end? No. I've never met a group, I've you know, discussed this all over the world. I've never met a group who put their hand up, who wants suffering and death? We can arrange it today. It's kind of no takers. Who wants happiness? It's a Pavlovian response. Everyone just puts their hand up. So that means there's a quality to the happiness we want. So again, we go back to Krishna's thing, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress. So what kind of happiness? He's talking about a non-permanent happiness. But we're talking about a permanent happiness. So this Sanskrit word ananda, means eternal happiness. So it's qualifying the kind of happiness we're aspiring to. So it's not a material. It's not a hit. You know, something that you just get a take a drink and you feel ha, but then it wears off. Or you take drugs, or you watch a box set, or whatever it is you do. These are hits, but these aren't happinesses that last forever. Then if you're looking for happiness that lasts forever, well, what part of you is looking for that? What part of it is infinite, eternal? And then they're identifying the self based on this. And if that's the case, if this idea of the self, this idea of Atma, then is not simply soul, it's self, but then you're talking about a self without end. And how Indian philosophers from the Upanishads on talk about it is the energy of life. And that's an energy that we have no idea about. We don't know what it means practically, I mean philosophically, but even scientifically. You know, we don't know what makes the heart beat. And when the heart stops beating, we can't plug it in. You know, we press it and we compress it and we electrify it and all that kind of stuff. But there comes a certain point in everyone's existence where we don't know what happened. And the heart stops beating, every chemical is exactly the same. What happened? We don't have a solution for it. So they're talking about, so that energy that animates the body. So the body is the self, but it doesn't last very long. The mind, a thought lasts seconds. One minute you're happy, next minute you're sad. So it's not identifying these parts of us as the self. We can self-identify as the body, as the mind, as the intellect. But they're observing that these things are changing too quickly. What's the part of us that is consistent? And they're saying, okay, this is the self we want to talk about. So if they're talking about that, about the Atma, about the self, then the idea of desire, bring back in the idea of desire, and desire then comes to mean choice. It's not simply what we want, it's what we choose to do. And this is where ideas of karma, etc. come in. But it's also understanding that the function of the eternal self, the one thing that the eternal self can do is choose. There's no other guarantee. The eternal self doesn't die because the eternal self wasn't born. The eternal self wasn't created. So now we've gone beyond creation. So how creative can that self be if it's beyond all material boundaries? And the biggest boundary is death. That's interesting thinking about how creative things can get. Now you link that individual self with the supreme self. So you can just, in some Indian philosophies, just talk about the individual self and that's enough. Some talk about the supreme self and the interconnection. How creative can that be? So that idea of self is beyond male and female. So therefore, one being identified as male and female at any given time is neither here nor there. It's not an issue. Our issues of identity, of male and female, of national identity, of capacity, are all pale into insignificance. So that then your possibility of creativity is expanded many more fold. Because if there's a part of us that is eternal beyond time and space, then that part is more powerful than the sun, which is bound by time and space, theoretically. So creatively, what's the potentiality? Beyond the laws of physics, it's super rational. And we're not talking about God, we're talking about ourselves. That's quite a concept. And then the ideas of creativity. So how much can you manipulate the material? How bound are you by sectarianism, by politics, by football? I mean, I have a brother-in-law who can't think beyond Manchester City. It's just Manchester City is the only football team that really exists. Yeah, it's very limited and very blue. I made the mistake. We hadn't known each other for very long, and I came home one time and I said, "Yeah, you're Arsenal, isn't it?" And of course, that was my other brother-in-law, and I'm not into football. I didn't care. It's just, and the look on his face told me everything. I was in trouble. Right. And in terms of the ability then to coexist, I was in Mumbai one time and I was walking up, I was in a car, going up a hill, and walking down on one side was a naked sadhu. This is in the middle of a city. A naked sadhu walking down the street with his hair all up and his trishul and little bowl and covered in ashes, and no one batted an eyelid. And walking up the other side was a Jain nun, done up head to toe, pristine clothes, mask over her face, covered. And the two of them just passing and existing in exactly the same space, and nobody thinking anything of it. I think the same thing in Heidelberg on any given day. either of those people or both at the same time. And you're in trouble, because it's not in ordinum. We're talking about cosmic order, but how cosmic order is interpreted means that cosmic order is complex. And here's a quote from Shakespeare. To deal with the self in the world, this spiritual idea of the self in the world, is kind of encapsulated. It's As You Like It. And it's Jacques is in a melancholy state and saying, all the world is a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. That's exactly Upanishadic philosophy. That the self plays many parts in one lifetime. You're a child and then you're a father. Completely different parts. At different times in your life, totally irrelevant. But who's playing the part? How attached do you get to play the part? And interestingly, if you don't identify with any of the parts, as the actor shouldn't, the actor should go out and play the part and then retain their identity, obviously. Otherwise, it's another form of madness. But if you can come and play the part with that detachment, appreciation of the bigger picture, and the necessity of the other parts, how better could you play your part? How more creative could you be? Where are your boundaries? So your part is played with a detachment, so you're not emotionally identifying with the insult that your teenage child hurls at you at a certain part of their development. That's possibly got something to do with hormones and brain development and stuff, and shouldn't be taken seriously.
Yeah, but they may not even like you, though.
and they may not even like you. Yeah. But if they actually don't like you, and it's not to do with the other stuff, still, you're only playing a part, and they're playing a part, so you just don't take it seriously. Which means you can play your part even through a storm, because there is a part to be played. Or do you just give up and walk off the stage in a huff? The teenager's going to do it. Someone has to stay on the stage. The show must go on. The whole passage is too long but the whole passage, we identify with each part of this passage. It's very well put as the stages of development of a life, ending with the last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history. It's second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. So it's just how we just dwindle. And of course, he's saying this in a melancholy way, and he's feeling really bad, and this is terrible. But from a Upanishadic point of view, this is a very positive observation. This is, oh, interesting, he got it right. And this is how we should. But if you don't have an idea of an eternal self, this is quite bleak. With the idea of the eternal self, this is like a manual as to how to act in the world. Just don't take it so seriously. Yourself has an existence beyond this body, and it has an existence beyond the part that we're playing just at the moment. And, so I'm giving a talk now, but then in a little while, someone else will be giving a talk and I'll be playing a different role. Adam will be very upset if I continue to play my role during his talk.
Feel free.
Back to this one. So we've dealt with divine and human to some degree. The thing about human is, interestingly, if we consider ourselves to be an atma, we're understanding our divine nature. So it's not only the supreme in terms of a Godhead, but we're connected with that umbilically in terms of quality and in terms of qualification. The human side of it becomes a little diminished. because if I'm an eternal entity, if my definition is that I am the life energy, then I'm equal to the vines outside that also have life energy, and to the giraffe in the zoo that also has life energy. So the human thing begins to sound a bit speciesist. Obviously racism isn't an issue and gender equality isn't an issue, because being a male, well, I'm a male now in this machine, but I could be in a female machine, you know, in some later period. So that's not a big issue. But we do favor humans over everyone else, and this says that's not necessarily the case. So then you have, someone mentioned about mythology, you have the Ramayana as a creative text. So this wonderful poetry, one of the oldest poems that we know of, I think, Adam, isn't it? Ramayana, it's a very, very old poem. But interesting in its composition. So Ram is a king, he's playing the part of a king. He's within 24 hours of being crowned king, he's the prince. He's not explaining the role of the king, he does that later on in the story. Within 24 hours, and he's asked to leave the kingdom. And he has a choice. And based on his own desire, his own choice, he chooses to accept this position, and he goes into the forest in exile with nothing. So he's actually living in a forest, has to make his own house, and just has some simple clothes. That's all he has to organize his own food, and has his wife and his brother are there. And then someone comes and kidnaps his wife, and what happens next? He develops an army. Who's in the army?
Monkeys.
Bears, squirrels, vultures. Interesting. Not a human to be seen, practically. It's interesting, the dynamic of the story. It's not a speciesist story. So Ram, in this case, the idea is he's an avatar. So he's God on Earth. But who's he interacting with? And he's interacting with all living beings. It's interesting in its composition. We have the avatars of Vishnu. So Vishnu manifests as 10 avatars, and more actually, but 10 main avatars. And who are they? What's the first one? Fish. Matsya the fish. Then Kurma the tortoise. Vraha the boar. Narasingha, half man, half lion. Pretty funky stuff. It's not speciesist. God isn't coming down saying, I'm only doing the human form. He comes down whatever form God chooses to be in. And he thinks inside the box and outside the box. And it's that ability to think inside and outside the box at the same time.
Somebody tried to connect with the Darwinian theory of evolution. The way the avatars have come, first as a fish, and then as a half tortoise, and then as a half human, and so on and so forth, in a sense, until the last one comes in the form of human beings, as the Darwinian theory of evolution says we are. So what's your comment on that?
Aurobindo and Bhaktivedanta Swami are two of the Indian commentators who have, a number have, but they're the ones who came up with interesting comments on Darwinian evolution, saying that, who cares? So they wouldn't go and look at the avatars from that point of view, because that's fitting the avatars into a human understanding of development. Whereas they're saying, well, that's very interesting, and maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. But, you know, so it's an interesting theory. But the issue of evolution in Indian consciousness is evolution of consciousness. And evolution of consciousness, if you're not dealing with evolution of consciousness, you're not actually dealing with evolution. The bodily thing isn't very important. And how the bodies form and transform, we understand that it's going to be a balanced affair, there's going to be chaos, there's going to be evolution, and there's going to be devolution. And we have to take that into account. So it's not simply a linear evolutionary process. They would say that it's a cyclical evolutionary process, and possibly spiral. You know, so they're just making it a little bit more complicated. and they're saying the material processes of evolution are not going to be linear. Where does that thinking come from? And it's Judaic thinking. Well, we know where it comes from. But they're saying that linear thinking is great, but if you don't link it with cyclical thinking, you're not dealing with how the world actually works. So there's evolution and devolution, and we think we're great, us humans, and there's a certain arrogance to it that I'm, you know, a bit scary. the kind of decisions we're making, you know, we're going to conquer illness, we're going to conquer death, and all that kind of stuff. Good luck with that. You know, we haven't made an impact at all. So their thing is, you know, look a bit higher and talk about evolution of consciousness. That's something you can do something with. It's something that is within our realm because it's got to do with our desire. Choices we can make can help evolve our thinking processes, etc. And the physical attributes, they'll go the way they go as they do because we have no control over them one way or the other. And that's seen in our bodily context. You know, so we're going through evolution in this body. We've gone through a cycle of 7 years, which means every single cell in our body has rejuvenated itself, has changed. So we've reincarnated every 7 years in this lifetime. So these are cycles that are going on that we have absolutely no control over. They're saying, so how can I remember being seven? What is that I? That's their concern. It's the evolution of that consciousness that is more important because the body's just doing its thing. I can't stop the grey hairs. I can't stop the lines and wrinkles and other things going on at this age. It's just part of a process. And I can use Grecian 2000 and, I don't know, get polyfiller into the cracks in the eye. You know, what's the point? this is just a thing that happens. So rather than put energy into that, put energy into evolution of consciousness. That's what they're saying. That's the kind of Indian creative experiment. And it's not to say that the body isn't a thing. And if you're totally absorbed in the body, well then, yeah, let's focus on that then. You know, and again, they got the way of doing that. Any other issues coming up from this?
Yeah. But desire, the desire is so strong on the essence that it actually motivates you to the next life. No, it's not because you said that it ends with death, but death's just a...
Well, no, desire particularly doesn't end with death.
Yes,
if desire is an intrinsic part of who we are.
Yeah.
But in Indian thought, desire is the potent part of ourselves. So our desire and who we decide we are. So we create ourselves. We create the world we live in and we create ourselves.
But the idea is that it goes and dictates where your next birth is as well.
That's when you're talking about karma and reincarnation.
Yeah.
That's all part of the cosmic order. Interestingly, Hinduism, Buddhism and Jainism, the one thing that they want to not talk about is karma and reincarnation. That's the thing they want to get away from. In a Western context, that's what everyone wants to talk about. So their thing is, you know, yes, because of our desire, we get entangled in material complexities and it becomes too complex. We can't understand what's going on. So we have to get out of that. We have to retract from that. So then how do you desire something other than material? And that becomes a kind of the spiritual issue. And then the traditions, and Hindu traditions get very creative about that. All Indian traditions do. So you've got six main philosophies in Hinduism, and I would say main philosophies because they subdivide quite a lot. And then Buddhism kind of turns its back on that, but it kind of doesn't. You know, and Jainism reacts to that, but it still takes its cue from basic Rig Vedic ideas. So they respond to the idea of Atma and say, okay, not for me. They totally get involved in the idea of karma. Desire is very important. You know, we should get away from suffering. You know, not desire this, but desire... and the idea of Sat, what is real. The Rig Vedic idea, very, very important. You know, the discerning what is real and what is not real.
But you conquer your desire so you get the moksha, no? Is that the idea that...
Yep.
When you desire less, then you're not going to stop the cycle of rebirth.
Yes, but is that actually creative enough? Because if you're desiring moksha, then you're still looking for a thing.
Yes.
But if you want love, for instance, then wouldn't you have to give up all desire? So you have the Shikshastikam from the 15th century, and Chaitanya says, Nadanam Najanam Nasundarim Kavitamva Jagadisha Kameya Janmani Janmani Janmanishvare. So birth after birth after birth. So he said, I don't want women, I don't want followers, I don't want wealth, but birth after birth, I just want the ability to love you.
But he's still wanting stuff.
What's that?
The ability to love after a desire.
Yes, but giving up all idea of salvation. So you're not asking, but you still want love, yeah. But you're not asking for anything.
But still wanting.
But still wanting.
In that position.
Exactly. But you go back to desire.
You can't give up desire.
If desire is an eternal function, then there's always wanting. So the question is, what do you want? So he's saying, a lot of people, when you get really pious, then you go, salvation. Yay, I want salvation. And then now you've got really pious. But then beyond that, he's saying, I just want an opportunity to serve you birth after birth. So now he's giving up the idea of salvation. Because he's saying, I can't love you if I want something from you. I only want to give to you. So how creative can we get? and how creative does the spiritual idea allow us to get? So then how does that qualify our desire? So desire isn't seen as a bad thing. There's a notion that desire is a bad thing. But it's like the definition of karma, I heard. Karma's a bitch, but only if you are. So it depends on our desire. So what are we desiring? And if you're desiring something spiritual, then it's not material. So it's not involved in karmic processes. It's excluded from that. So that's you're dealing with different realm of possibilities. But how do you get to the stage of desirelessness? We talk about desire, but we're talking about material desirelessness. We're not talking about being without desire.
I think that part of the answer to that possibly, but I know much, is in that Ramanaya, the original story, because when he leaves the kingdom, he goes to the forest, like you just mentioned, and his concern is for all of creation. Not for himself, but all of creation. The idea of Christ is all of creation.
Mm.
The notion of big self with a capital S is associated with all of the animals, all of the plants, all of the minerals, everything. Mm. Not just the continuation of a personal
It's interesting. It's exactly the point of the Ramayana. I mean, you really hit it.
It's the same story for the Buddha. It's exactly the same story. Slightly differently clothed, but he goes to the forest, and he wants. And the practice is always for all sentient beings.
Yeah.
It's the same story.
It's funny you mentioned the same story. We had a student here doing a master's, and she was working on a 17th century Vaishnav text. And she was in brilliant manuscript collections in the Bodh, and this is before they moved a lot of the manuscripts out of the Bodh, so you could go into the stacks and find manuscripts that were uncatalogued. So she went and she found an uncatalogued manuscript, and it was older than the one she was studying, and it was a Shaivite manuscript, and it was exactly the same manuscript, except it was in glorification of Shiva. And then her author had taken Shiva and put in Vishnu. So what kind of creativity is that? But it's interesting that in Indian culture, there's no idea of plagiarism. You know, creativity also means that you find something really good, a really good idea, you just take it into your own tradition. So there in the 19th century, there was a revival of bhajan in Bengal. And so the writers of the bhajan, so bhajans are spiritual songs in a religious context, but they were borrowing from the bowls and all the popular singers. And then they would, you know, so it was like you're singing a hymn, oh, but all of a sudden you're singing hymns, you know, hey, Vishnu, you know. So in the 19th century, it sounded like that. And it was a bit of innovation. Now when we sing those bhajans, it sounds, you know, it's 19th century, you know, so we've moved on. But the idea of just borrowing a song and making it a bhajan by taking out the word Delilah and putting in the word Radha, and it's that totally exemplifies what I want to say. That'll do.
But that's not just plagiarism, is a relatively recent thing in Western thought as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just.
Oh, yeah,
these
yeah.
These were the kind of things that they did all the time in Christian culture too. They were constantly.
Yeah.
Culture, they were constantly moving and shifting.
Borrowing. Isn't it capitalism that messed us all up on that?
It's an intellectual property.
Yeah.
The notion of intellectual property is very recent.
Yeah. But it started, say, the enclosures in the 1700s and the 18th century here in Otmore, the enclosures in Otmore just up the road, in the 1860s, and some of the local residents in the village where I live were arrested for trying to stop the enclosures and you know, because people just went and said, this is my land. And said, what? Mm-hmm. And before that, their idea was God's land. It was just land, you know. So the idea of ownership per se. So it just started to infect everything. No, you're perfectly right.
There's a lovely example of that. When I was in India, I went to a Sai Baba temple, and he was born to a Muslim family, and he was a spiritual teacher. He was inclusive of difference. He wasn't concerned with religion. He was concerned with spiritual values. And then he was adopted by Hinduism as an incarnation of Krishna. You can't get more creative than that.
Yeah.
You can't. Wonderful.
Yep. Good. Time for one more question. And we'll wrap it up. I think we have teas and coffees. Or do we? Have I misspoken? Yes, we do. Oh, thank God. Anything else? No? Good. Okay, so anyway, my thing was just to whet your appetite, start you off. We launch into Adam afterwards, some concrete examples, literally.
I'll just be illustrating the sort of stuff you've been talking about.
Hopefully. Okay, thank you all very much, and tea and coffees are just outside.
Thank you.